The 100 Years' War, the Duguesclin Period, The Good Parliament, Part 2. John of Gaunt was initially inclined to dismiss everyone as country bumpkins, knights of the hedgerows, as he liked to call them. This was a mistake, as one of his squires told him to his face, they were no common men, but experienced and powerful men of war, with friends and kinsmen amongst the most powerful men in the land. It soon became clear that those friends and kinsmen included much of the lay peerage and all of the king's sons other than Gaunt himself. The Prince of Wales, a dying man but a powerful symbol, ostentatiously refused to support the king's ministers in their troubles. The Earl of March would not have allowed his Stuart to serve as the common spokesman unless he was of the same mind. Indeed, in some ways, his career exemplified the disappointments which the lay peerage shared with the knights. A man of large ambition, he had a name to live up to. He was too young to have shared in the achievements of Edward III's prime, yet his military achievements at the age of 23 consisted of his participation in an abortive naval expedition of 1372 and the unsuccessful campaign in Brittany in 1375. He had raised his own company of 800 men to fight in Brittany and would have fought in the service of John de Montfort if he had not been peremptorily recalled to England. It was a loss of face, which obviously he felt personally. On May the 9th, 1376, Sir Peter de Mare came before the Lords in answer to the King's summons. The Lords sat in the Whitehall, a bare stone hall next to the painted chamber in the heart of the palace. When he entered the intimidating surroundings of the chamber, the doors were closed behind him, and most of his colleagues shut out. John of Gaunt, presiding, commanded him to state his business. De la Mare refused to be browbeaten. Would not speak until the whole commons was present for what one of us says we all say. When the rest of the commons were eventually brought into the hall, the speaker presented the commons' request for the appointment of a committee of peers to deliberate with them. The commons, he said, wished to discuss with them many faults and grave problems which they had identified in the king's administration and which would have to be remedied before they could deal with the king's demands for a subsidy. The Lords, after discussing this briefly amongst themselves, agreed, and after obtaining the King's consent, the Commons nominated 4 bishops, 4 earls, and 4 barons, who they wished to see on the intercommuning committee. The bishops selected included none of the men who were closely connected with the royal administration, and one, Courtney of London, who had already shown himself to be one of the most articulate opponents. The earls and barons were all men who had made a name for themselves as soldiers in past campaigns. The king and the prince had been present for the opening sessions of Parliament, but they were sick men who could no longer attend to business for more than short periods. Edward withdrew shortly afterwards to his private apartments in the Palace of Westminster, and the prince to the manor at Kennington. They featured in their unfolding crisis as distant figures, informed and consulted at crucial moments, but forever offstage. In their absence, the defense of the government's interests fell to John of Gaunt. He played a weak hand badly. Gaunt did not have the same status and authority as his father and elder brother, and his dominant role at the peace conference had identified him too closely with the perceived limpness of English policy towards France. Moreover, he was not by nature a conciliator. He was an exalted conception of the royal authority, was outraged by the presumption of the knights, and his first instinct was to try and overawe the commons by a show of force. "I do not think they realize how powerful I am," a hostile source records him as saying. He was dissuaded from this course by the advice of his own men. They pointed out to him that the parliamentary knights had too much support to be intimidated in this way. Apart from the prince and much of the nobility, they had important allies in the city of London. If they threatened, the Londoners would likely come to their defense. Gaunt himself and his friends and allies would be in serious danger. 12 members of the Lords Committee conferred with the Commons on the morning of May the 12th. They fell in with the proposals of the knights after what appears to have been a very perfunctory discussion. Later that day, the Commons, accompanied by the 12, appeared before John of Gaunt and the peers to present the Commons' response to the government's opening statement. Sir Peter de Mare spoke for them. "The Lords," he said, have no idea how heavily the burden of past war taxation, year upon year, had weighed upon the Commons. Even this they would have borne with patience if the war had gone well. Indeed, they could have borne defeat as well if their money had been well spent, but they wanted a full account of where the money had gone. With the great sums that had been received from the ransoms of the King of France and Scotland, and from past grants of taxation, there ought to be immense sums still unspent in the treasury, without any need for further taxation. If they were not, then the king was being defrauded by his servants. The Duke of Lancaster asked for names. Sir Peter named Latimer, Lyons, and Alice Perez. Then he expanded on the charges against them, persisting in the face of constant heckling from John of Gaunt, Latimer, and other peers who claimed to know the facts. Latimer and Lyons, Sir Peter alleged, had undermined the Calais staple, thereby impoverishing the merchants of the kingdom and increasing the burden of defending the town on the royal treasury. They had rejected an offer of interest-free loan which the staple merchants of Calais had offered, on the condition that the government abandon the sale of licenses to avoid the staple ordinances. Instead, they lent their money themselves at an extortionate rate of interest. Commons wanted to conduct a full investigation of this transaction and called for the last two treasurers, both of whom were sitting among the lords, to give evidence about it. Next, Sir Peter turned to the systematic buying up of dishonored royal debt at a discount which Latimer and Lyons had procured to be paid by the treasury at par for the benefit of themselves and their friends. This was likely to be a popular theme, for many of those present had lost money by the king's repudiation of his debts. Sir Peter's final charge was leveled against an equally unpopular target, the king's mistress, Alice Perez. Sir Peter demanded an end to the flow of gifts to Alice and declared that it would be a great advantage to the realm if she were removed from the king's company. For the next 2 weeks, the Commons worked with designated committee of lords on the preparation of their case against the king's ministers. They looked for material to discredit them wherever they could find it, without much care for accuracy or objectivity. The Commons already knew a fair amount about the loan of August 1374, because both aldermen sat for the City of London had been involved. Some further information came to light on May the 19th when they took evidence in Whitehall from Richard Scrope, who had been treasurer at the time. The Commons cried out with one voice when this evidence established that Latimer and Lyons had been behind the loan and that money might have come from the King's Chamber. Fresh material came into the hands when Sir John Ainslie, Nottinghamshire knight whose wife had inherited a share of the barony of Saint-Savar, publicly accused its captain, Thomas Catterton, of having treasonably sold the place to the French. Catterton had been, and possibly still was, a retainer of Latimer. Commons saw the chance to broaden the inquiry to cover Latimer's responsibility for the collapse of the English positions in France. They resolved to accuse him of being privy to the sale of Saint-Savar. At the same time, they began to look into the custody of Boucherelle, which had been lost 3 years earlier at a time when Latimer was nominally its captain. A roll was obtained apparently from the records of the Exchequer recording ransoms collected at Boucherelle in Latimer's time, which provided the basis for charges of extortion and embezzlement going back to the early 1360s. To this was added accusations that he had procured the release of French spies caught in England, that he had failed to supply the fortress properly or to pay its garrison, and even that he had deliberately frustrated the naval expedition of 1372, which had been intended to relieve the place. These weighty, though unsubstantiated, allegations were filled out with a variety of petty charges of embezzlement or misuse of office against Latimer and Lyons themselves and various minor officials who could have shown to have connection with them. By comparison, the most that they could find to throw at John Neville, the other man associated with the direction of the king of the war on the king's council, was that his retinue had pillaged the villages of Hampshire while awaiting embarkation for Brittany in 1372, and he had obtained repayment in full of two ancient royal debts which he had bought at a discount. A lot of charges with a very little amount of proof, but it certainly looks bad for these men. Now, the sources for this, The Hundred Years' War, The Chronicles by Froissart, The Hundred Years' War by Perrois, The Hundred Years' War by Nylens, and The Hundred Years' War, The House Divided, Volume 3 by Sumption. So I hope you enjoyed that, and as always, don't forget to come by the website, summahistorica.com or historyaccordingtobob.com, and ask a question, leave a comment, check out our merchandise, and if you like what we're doing, please feel free to support us. Thank you very much.